Thank you, Dave, and happy Sabbath to all the brethren here. That song happens to be my favorite song in all of the songs that we sing, and I was whistling it today in the shower before I got down here. So I got a double dose of it today. Seems there was this fellow stranded on this desert island. And he'd been there for months and months and months. He was all by himself. Finally, a rescue boat comes along, and he gets in the boat, and he tells the captain, he said, "Man," he said, "I can't wait to get back to find out how my GM stock is doing." This lady goes in the post office, and she puts a letter up on the scale, and the attendant tells her that this letter is a little too big. It weighs too much, and she'll have to add another stamp. So she looks a little bit puzzled, and she says, "Well, won't that add more weight?" This woman is wheeled into the delivery room, and she told the nurse, she said, "I remember you from the last birth that I had here at the hospital." Well, the nurse was so thrilled, especially since it's been a number of years. She said, "Do you really remember me?" She says, "Really?" She was milking it for another compliment, and this lady says, "Of course I remember you. You're the nurse that ate up all my candy." One last little joke here about this young guy that walks into the parts store working on his car, and he's a little washer. He goes in and he gets this washer and he takes it up the counter, and the clerk says, "Well, that'll be 15 cents. This kid says, "15 cents? Are you out of your mind? 15 cents for that washer? I'll forget that. I'll go home and drill a hole in a quarter." You don't want him running your parts department. You'll go broke in a hurry. I hadn't really thought about a name for this message today until Brian Bell asked me about it. I'm going to call it idolatry because that's really what it's all about. I'm going to start out today in Exodus 20, because that's where the commandment about idolatry or against idolatry really is. And the second commandment starts in Exodus 20 and verse 4. There's three verses here. Moses wrote down, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that's in heaven above, or that's in the earth beneath, or that's in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them. For I, the Eternal, your God, am a jealous God." Listen to this. "Visiting the iniquities of the fathers upon their children to the third and fourth generation of those that hate me." And verse 6 says, "However, showing mercy to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments." So the Eternal has reserved flexibility for himself in that point. Since we're in the same chapter, let's move on to something that's a little bit interesting to me here. Exodus 32. And verses 2, 3, and 4. Moses had gone up to the mountain to receive the tablets, and Aaron said to the children of Israel, "Break off your golden earrings and that are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. Then he said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you up out of the land of Egypt." Sort of odd that while Moses is up in this mountain less than a mile away, writing down the second commandment, don't make any graven image, his brother is down at the base of this mountain doing the very thing he's told not to do. Of course, he hadn't received the commandment yet, but it's just really interesting to me to see that this paradox is going on between the older and the younger brother. And after he had made this calf, in verse 5, Aaron says, "Tomorrow," he made a proclamation, and he said, "Tomorrow we're going to have a feast to the Eternal." And the feasts were not listed yet. He had no idea what the feasts were going to be. But he's going to have a party tomorrow without his brother there. Well, all that changed, of course, as we know, And the calves are broken down, and they were thrown in the stream, and the people were made to drink the water. But one of the places where idolatry is talked against a lot is in the book of Isaiah. I'm going to read several points here from the book of Isaiah. Isaiah has quite a bit to say about it. And it's quite an indictment in some cases here. Isaiah 40 and verse 18 through 20. Isaiah 40, 18 through 20. What Isaiah is doing here at this point is he's trying to find out what people can compare the Creator to. And of course, it's futile, and he begins to point that out here. To whom will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare to him? The workman molds an image. The goldsmith overspreads it with gold. And the silversmith casts silver chains. Well, that's for somebody that who had a lot of money. That was an upper-class citizen. Whoever's too impoverished for such a contribution chooses a tree that will not rot. So he's going to have a maple tree or an oak tree, a hardwood tree of some kind, and seeks for himself a skilled workman to prepare a carved image that will not totter. Couple pages over in Isaiah 41, God is speaking. He's entering the picture at this point. And so God is challenging idols and people with idols. Isaiah 41. I'm going to start out in verse 21. The Eternal says, present your cases, Eternal. Bring forth strong reasons. Bring forth your best reasons. The strongest reasons you got, says the King of Jacob. Let them bring forth and show us what's going to happen. Let them show the former things what they were, and we can consider them and know the latter end of them, or declare to us the things that are going to come. Show the things that are going to come hereafter, that we may know that you really are gods. Yes, do some good or some evil that we may be dismayed. In other words, be terrified over what we see. And see it together. These things don't happen with idols because they don't have any value. The Eternal's thought here in verse 24 about an idolater. Look what he says. Indeed, you're nothing. Your work is nothing. He who chooses you is an abomination. Very, very strong and cutting words. This is the type of thing that many of us have come out of. Verse 26. Who has declared from the beginning that we may know? And the former times that we may say, he is righteous. Surely there's no one who shows. Surely there's no one who declares. Surely there's no one who hears your words. A lot of the scientists today and researchers believe that the world is some 4 billion years old. There's another group of scientists here a couple of years ago that think it's only about 150,000 years old. The confusion reigns all across the face of the earth to this day. People just don't know. Modern man still can't figure it out with all of his telescopes, all the time-space ideas that we have. We still don't have an idea or an inkling of it. But it really doesn't matter to us how old the earth is. What matters is that there was a creator and an engineer that designed it all. It's just astounding. Let's move on down to verse 28. For I looked, and there was no man. I looked among them, but there was no counselor who, when I asked of them, could answer a word. In other words, what is the value of one of these things? Indeed, they're all worthless, verse 29. Their works are nothing. Their molded images are wind and confusion. Isaiah 44. Isaiah has a little bit more to say. Verses 9 and 10. Those who make an image, all of them are useless. It's continuing on the very same theme. And their precious things shall not profit. They're their own witnesses. They neither see nor know, that they may be ashamed. They don't even know what shame is. Verse 10. Who would form a god or mold an image that profits him absolutely nothing? Their effort is in complete vain uselessness. Verse 12. Here's how some of these are done. There's a blacksmith. The blacksmith with the tong works an idol with coals, or in the coals, fashions it with hammers. He works it with the strength of his arms. Even so, he's hungry, and his strength eventually fails. He drinks no water, and he's faint. He has more capacity than the idol that he's making, but he doesn't understand that. His mind doesn't comprehend that, and he's making this thing for himself. His work is for nothing. Go down to verse 13 through 17. Listen to these five verses because they're very unusual. At least to me, they're unusual. The craftsman stretches out his rule. He marks one out with chalk. He fashions it with a plane. He marks it out with a compass. He makes a figure like a man. So he's going to make a high quality idol. It's not going to be a bug or a mouse or a rat or a snake. It's going to be high quality stuff. He's going to make it after a man. According to the beauty of a man, that it may remain in the house. He's not going to have it outside. He's going to bring it in the house. So he cuts down cedars for himself, takes the cypress and the oak. He secures it for himself among the trees of the forest, plants a pine, and rain nourishes it. Then it shall be for a man to burn. He'll take some of it and warm himself, get nice and warm. He kindles it and bakes bread with some of it from the fire. He makes a god and worship it. He makes a carved image and falls down to it. He burns half of it in the fire. With this half, he eats meat. He roasts roasts and has a barbecue. He loves it. He's staying nice and warm. I see Price smiling over there. He has some tri-tip. It's great. Then he says, ah, I'm nice and warm. I've seen the fire. I've been around the fire, and that's great. The rest of it he makes into a god, his carven image, and falls down to it and worships it. He prays to it and says, deliver me, for you're my God. Help me. Have mercy on me. Forgive my sins. All the things that people think about when they have an idol. They want this thing to perform for them and to do good for them. But unfortunately, it doesn't always work out that way. Verse 19. And no one considers in his heart, nor is there knowledge nor understanding to say, I've burned half of it in the fire. Yes, I have. I've also baked bread on his coals. I've also roasted meat and eaten it. Now shall I make the rest into an abomination? That word appears again and again when God is dealing with idols here and talking about them. Shall I fall down to a block of wood? I fall down to a block of wood? What was this idolater feeding on? Was he feeding on bread? Was he feeding on a roast? Verse 20 says right here, this fellow is feeding on ashes. He's feeding on ashes. He's eating ashes because that doesn't get him any place. His idea and the things that he's following don't have any value. A deceived heart has turned him aside, and he cannot deliver his soul. Nor can he say, isn't there a lie in my right hand? Don't I have a lie in my right hand? People can't comprehend that and see that. Isaiah gets some support for a fellow in Judges 6 and verse 30. Judges 6 and verse 30. Similar things are said right here. And this is Gideon's father. Gideon had been instructed by the Eternal to go out and break down the altar of Baal, which he had just done, and then take the idol of Baal, which was there, made of wood, and chop that thing up into kindling, and then take his father's bull and sacrifice it using the wood from Baal. And that's what's just happened. He did that in the evening at night so that when the men of the city, they woke up and here's what they're talking about. The men of the city said to Joash, which was Gideon's father, bring out your son, get him out here. Get him out here now, that he can die. Because he's torn down the altar of Baal, and because he's cut down the wooden image that was beside it. Well, they were mad. But Joash, who was Gideon's father, said to all who stood against him, are you guys going to plead for Baal? You're going to save him? Let the one who would plead for Baal be put to death by mourning. Because if Baal is a god, let him come down here and plead for himself, because his altar has been torn down. You see, Gideon's father understood that this thing was worthless. And the men of the city could see that it was worth it, as it couldn't defend itself from being burned, from being chopped down. Couldn't defend himself from that. Gideon's father was the only one that saw that. Next, we're going to go to an idolater named Jeroboam, who was the king of Israel in 1 Kings 12. David and Solomon, and before them Saul, were the kings of the united country, Israel and Judah. But Jeroboam is the one that broke the country in two. And then from that point, he started out in idolatry almost immediately to try to preserve the people for himself. 1 Kings 12, verse 28. Interesting thing about this to me was that here is Jeroboam following in the same footsteps that Aaron had done at Mount Sinai. Therefore, the king had asked advice in verse 28. So he was seeking counsel. He wanted to know what he should do to help keep the kingdom together. Well, he wound up making two calves of gold and said to the people, look, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up out of Egypt. Now, he wound up putting one of those calves, those gods, those idols, in Dan, which was completely, probably the northernmost city, the city of Israel. And the other one he put down in the southernmost area in a place called Bethel. Now, what's interesting about Bethel is that it's only about 9 more miles down to Jerusalem. It's not very far, about 2 hours walk, 9 or 10 miles, and you'll be in Jerusalem. The 2 more hours is all these people had to walk. There was no need to put the thing down there. But I think he did it because it would prevent Israel from going to Jerusalem to worship the true God. And that would be a point where they would put a stop to people going farther down. There are a lot of different gods in Egypt and many of these other countries. They worship mice and beetles and frogs and snakes and just anything. They made idols out of everything. A bull is a different type of an idol in the sense that you're... I grew up on my father's farm. We didn't have breeder cattle. We had feeder cattle. But there's neighbors around us that had these breeding stock. And some of these bulls that are 7, 8 years old are extremely powerful. Sometimes you can't do nothing with them. They put rings in their noses. And people like Perry knows, they they latch onto them and pull them around. Otherwise, you can't do anything with them. They're a mighty, mighty strong animal, and some can get vicious. So you have, when you're around them, you have to pay attention to them. And I could see that being one of the reasons why people would want to make an idol out of a bull, but I can't see that out of anything else. People are around these animals a lot in the agrarian societies. But they got to realize also that God is the one who made the bull in the first place, who created it years ago and sustained it. But some of these things were just bizarre looking things that they had built. Just like Aaron had a big party plan, Jeroboam did the same thing in verse 32. It says, Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah. What he did was take the Feast of Tabernacles and do away with it and set it back 1 month. They had a different kind of a feast. They didn't have a feast of God. They had a feast of these two calves. And Mr. Armstrong has contended that that could have been the beginning of Halloween, because this Baal worship is sacrificing to demons all of the time. And he offered sacrifices on this altar. So he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made. And at Bethel he installed the priests of the high places which he had made. Verse 31, Jeroboam made shrines on the high places and made priests from every class of people who were not the sons of Levi. Now, anybody who could, who wanted to be a priest could be a priest, and I'm sure there was some sort of kickback put in place so the king became wealthy over this stuff. Let's go on to another king. This king is a king of Judah. This king's name is Manasseh, 2 Chronicles 33. Now, Manasseh started out when he was 12 years old, and he was an idolater from his youth. Manasseh was 12 years old, verse 1, when he became king, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. But he did evil, and did he ever, in the sight of the Eternal, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Eternal had cast out before the children of Israel. He rebuilt the high places his father, and his father Hezekiah was righteous, which Hezekiah his father had broken down. He raised up altars for the Baals. He made wooden images, and he worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. He also built altars in the house of the Eternal. Right in God's church he built an altar, of which the Eternal had said, in Jerusalem, in Jerusalem shall my name be forever. And he built altars for all the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Eternal. He also caused his sons to pass through the fire in the valley of the son of Hinnom. He practiced soothsaying. He used witchcraft. He used sorcery. He consulted mediums. He consulted spiritists. He did much evil in the sight of the Eternal to provoke him to anger. He even set up a carved image, the idol which he made, in the house of God, of which God had said to David and to Solomon his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I'll put my name forever. That's the kind of a man that became the king. The Eternal permitted it to happen. Verse 10 says, and the Eternal spoke to Manasseh and to his people. They wouldn't listen. Now here's God's solution in verse 11. It's coming up. The Eternal brought upon them, the Israelites, the captains of the army of the king of Assyria, who took Manasseh with hooks and bound him with bronze fetters and carried him off to Babylon. God's solution for Manasseh was war, which was the case in other cases as well. Verse 12, something unusual is going on right here. Now when Manasseh was in affliction, he implored the Eternal, his God, and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers, before Hezekiah's God. You see, he's in jail now and things aren't going well at all. They can only get worse. But where is his God? Where is Baal and Ashtaroth? Where are they? Why isn't he praying to them? Why isn't he praying to an oak idol or maple or pine? Where are the idols of gold and silver for Manasseh here? There aren't any. Where are those ashes that were so important just months before? They don't mean anything when he's in prison. He doesn't want to call out to those idols at that point in time. He wants the Creator God, the merciful God, the God of love and mercy to hear him. Not those idols that he made. And we're no different. Verse 13. And he prayed to the Eternal, and the Eternal received his entreaty, heard his supplication, and brought him back to Jerusalem, into his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Eternal was God. He finally understood after all that stuff that he had to go through. The next couple of verses, we're going to see the fruits of the Spirit, of God's Spirit, in Ephesians 5:22. Verse 14 says, after this, he built a wall outside the city of David on the west side of Gihon, I guess it is, in the valley, as far as the entrance to the fish gate. And it enclosed Ophel, and he raised it to a very great height. He put military captains in all the fortified cities of Judah. Verse 15, he took away the foreign gods. Aha! And the idol from the house of the Eternal. Here's true repentance. He really meant it. And all the altars that he had built in the mount of the house of the Eternal and in Jerusalem, and he cast them out of that city. He also repaired the altar of the Eternal, sacrificed peace offerings and thank offerings on it, and commanded Judah to serve the Eternal God of Israel. Nevertheless, the people still sacrificed in the high places, however, only to the Eternal their God. What was happening here? First scripture I read was Exodus 20, and in Exodus 20, verse 6 says, showing mercy to Manasseh and to those who love me and who keep my commandments. Here was an extremely evil king that even executed his own, at least his first son, that's usually what they did, in the fire down in the valley of Hinnom. And yet the Eternal forgave that man, just as he said he would, with people who dabble with idols and come to their senses and repent. Another king of Judah, this one is Solomon, in 1 Kings 3 and verse 3. Solomon had a great start in life. His father David was, as we all know, a man after God's own heart. He couldn't have had a better example. Well, maybe he could have. But at least he had a good example. His father followed Almighty God all of the days of his life. He had some problems, but he repented of them, as we can all see. Chapter 3 and verse 3, it says, Solomon loved the Eternal, just the opposite of Manasseh, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. Verse 5 said, at Gibeon, the Eternal appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. And God said, ask what you shall, and I'll give you. And as we all know, Solomon asked for wisdom. He wanted to have wisdom to judge the people, which was a great thing to ask for. What was God's response to that? In verse 10, it says, Solomon's speech pleased the Eternal that Solomon had asked this thing. Solomon started out just the opposite of Manasseh. Solomon started out on the right path, going the right way. Manasseh did not. He started at the worst possible place you could start. His mind was just all backwards. It wasn't right at all. But somehow along the path of life, Solomon got fouled up. 1 Kings 11, point that out, verses 4 through 8. We can see here that these idols that Solomon began worshiping caused his demise. For so it was when Solomon was old that his wife turned his heart again after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Eternal his God, as was the heart of his father David. Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Eternal and did not fully follow the Eternal as did his father David. Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abominations of Moab, on the hill that's east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. Manasseh started out in the depths of depravity and repented and received mercy. Solomon, on the other hand, started very high with an excellent example. Of course, Manasseh did too with his father Hezekiah. But he started out right and went down, 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 down at the end of his life. Went the opposite direction. And he had all kinds of good things going for him. It's just amazing. Verses 9 and 10. So the Eternal became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned from the Eternal God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. And he commanded him concerning this very thing, that he should not go after other gods. But he did not keep what the Eternal commanded him. Back in Exodus 20 and verse 4, here's what the commandment says, the first thing that I read. You shall not make for yourselves a carved image, Solomon, any likeness of anything that's in heaven above, or that's in the earth, in earth beneath, or that's in the water under the earth. Verse 5, you shall not bow down to them, period. Something happened to Solomon's mind, which was the opposite of what happened to Manasseh's mind. When Manasseh was in prison, he was capable of repenting. And Solomon was unable to do that. How ironic it is that Solomon wrote so much. We read so much about Solomon in Ecclesiastes, in the Proverbs that he wrote, Song of Solomon, and they believe that some of the Psalms are written by him. Because all this knowledge of Solomon's mind in the Holy Scriptures, yet there isn't a single word about Manasseh. Yet Manasseh repented and received mercy. It appears Solomon did not. Could it be possible that Manasseh could reach the first resurrection and Solomon not be there at all? How ironic that would be. I don't know if that's going to happen. I'm not his judge. I'm just throwing that out there because there's such a dichotomy here. 1st place idols are mentioned in the Holy Scriptures is in Genesis 31. This is about Jacob's journey from, not so much about his journey from the land of Canaan, but his journey after he got up to his father-in-law Laban and is returning. He's about to return back to his parents' place in Canaan. He's been living up in Syria for many years. Some people believe 20 years, other people believe 40 years. But my comments aren't about that today. But he's about to leave and get away from his father-in-law and return to his father. And in verse 3, Genesis 31 and verse 3 says, "The Eternal said to Jacob, 'Return to your land, to your fathers and to your family, and I'll be with you.' So Jacob sent and called Rachel his wife and Leah his wife to the field to his flock." Verse 5 says, "And he said to them, 'I see that your father's countenance,'" in other words, his demeanor, his mannerisms, and the way that he looked and the way he talked, "that it is not favorable toward me as before." So in other words, problems are arising. What is happening is that the property that Laban had was increasing, but not at the rate that Jacob's property was increasing. God was blessing Jacob, and he was not blessing Laban to the extent that he was blessing Jacob, even though Jacob was a hired hand. One of the reasons was Jacob followed the God of his father Abraham, and Laban was an idolater. "Your father's countenance is not favorable to me as before, but the God of my father has been with me, and you know that with all my might I've served your father. Yet your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times. But God did not allow him to hurt me." So they decided to leave. The decision was made that things weren't going well and they probably weren't getting any better. They decided to go back to Canaan, back to Bethel. Verse 19, this is the very next thing that takes place. "Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the idols that were her father's." Rachel was an idolater. No other reason for her to have idols other than the fact that she believed in idolatry. What's odd about this, if she'd been married to Jacob, she'd be roughly 59 years old, give or take a little bit. And she should have been able to see all the phenomenal blessings that were given to her husband versus how much was given to Laban, her father. But for some reason, that didn't compute to her. She wanted those little trinkets. So she stole them. But Laban had a lot of cattle. He had a lot of sheep. So did Jacob. A lot of camels, gold, silver, servants, and so on. So they leave, and Laban overtakes Jacob in verse 25, and he is mad. He's mad. Verse 30 shows why. "And now you have surely gone because you greatly long for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods?" Why did you steal my gods? Jacob doesn't know that that's going on. He doesn't have any idea that's going on. Now in verse 32, something unusual happens here. Laban wants to go and search all of Jacob's contents. And Jacob unwittingly pronounces the death sentence on his wife, on his wife Rachel. Bear in mind, she's the one that stole the idols. Jacob says, "With whomever you find your gods, do not let him live. In the presence of our brethren, identify what I have of yours and take it with you." Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. Verse 33. Laban went into Jacob's tent, into Leah's tent, and into the two maids' tents, but he did not find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had stolen the idols, put them in the camel's saddle, and sat on them. And Laban searched all about the tent, but did not find them. She said to her father, "Let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is with me." And he searched, but did not find the idols. When they left Haran up there where they were, very close to the Euphrates River, Jacob had about a 10-day head start on Laban, because Laban didn't find out about this till several days later. By the time Laban caught up with Jacob, they were already in the mountains of Gilead. It's a distance of about 300 plus miles that they traveled. They had driven them flocks hard as they could drive them night and day to cover those 300 miles to get back to Canaan to safety. They didn't quite make it because Gilead is a little ways above, probably 60 miles or so above the Sea of Galilee. They didn't quite make it back into Canaan, but they made it into the area where Manasseh would eventually settle. So that's how far they got. And of course, we know that he wrestled with God there and that later he had to deal with his brother Esau coming. But let's go on to chapter 35 and verses 1 and 2. They're going on to Bethel and they're going to sacrifice there, as you'll see here in a moment. Then God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau your brother." And Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Put away your foreign gods that are among you. Purify yourselves," in other words, wash yourselves, "and change your garments." And that's what he had instructed them to do because they were going to Bethel to worship. In verse 18, on their way from Bethel, they had gone to Bethel. Verse 18 says, "And so it was, as Rachel's soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name, her son, Benoni. But his father called him Benjamin," which means "son of my right hand." So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Bethlehem. It left Bethel and went south and was going to Bethlehem, which is about 4 miles south of Jerusalem. So that's only about a 14, 15-mile jaunt for them. Anyway, she was buried there by the road. And here's why I believe that Jacob pronounced his death sentence on his wife Rachel. In Exodus 20 and verse 5, it says, "You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, Rachel, for I, the Eternal, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquities of the fathers upon the daughters to the third and fourth generation of those that hate me." These are clear-cut examples of situations in the scripture that go back to the commandments, the basis for all righteousness. And Rachel Leah did not get caught up in that, but Rachel did. Leah is not mentioned as being part of it. But these things have gone on in these lives of these various people that I'm here talking about. And when we read these things, there's a lot of information that we can put together like that. It's all over. Well, today I've spoken about idols of wood and stone, idols of gold and silver. But in the New Testament, Paul talks about anything or everything could become an idol to us if we put our mind to it, not just something that we carve out and set up and bow down to it. Anything we lust after can be an idol. We can lust after sports. We can lust after an automobile that has all the chrome and all the goodies on it. We can lust after so many pair of shoes that would cover everybody's feet in this auditorium. We can lust after all those kinds of things. We can lust after anything, everything. We can make idols of everything around us. And just like those people that didn't understand, all this comes out of our heart. What we desire comes from here, comes from our mind. It's what we seek after. What is it that we put before our Creator? That becomes an idol against us. And most of these things in time to come don't benefit us one way or the other. I don't have time to go into what Paul was talking about because of the film coming up here in a moment, but the New Testament is filled with this kind of spiritual understanding. What's unusual about this is that Christ doesn't talk about this in the Sermon on the Mount. He left it up to Paul to talk about, and Paul talks about it at great length, and it's really a story for another time. It's not one that I have time to go into today. But idolatry is something that's with us today. It's all around us. I don't mean in just in terms of people having trinkets hanging around their neck or on the walls or anything like that. I'm talking about what's in our own hearts. And that's what we have to look at, and that's what we have to be aware of. We have to be aware of our surroundings all the time because things can creep in, and we can begin following things and get our mind away from our Creator, and that's the worst thing that can happen. It happened to Solomon, so keep him in mind.